那声问马拉祖经在这样 he's out of style But now I'm here to tell you Dare you press in heaven now Life's story, love and glory If you listen when it plays it for you now listen and listen and dig it Catch it in deep Let's stay young as play
And we're back.
Nay.
What happened to Jeff?
We seem to have lost Jeff, but this is the Linux Show for Tuesday, June 10th, 2003. Jeff, you there?
I'm here.
And we're back on the air.
that was weird. Huh? I get dropped off right at the start of the show. Evil omen. It is the Linux Show for what is it? June 10th, 2003. You probably already said that, right, Kevin?
Yep.
Panic! we are back with another regular episode of the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show. Welcome back to all you regular listeners and all you people out in the IRC chat room. Thank you for coming back after our 1 week in voluntary hiatus. About a week ago at this time, I was up to my elbows in server. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon is when our server just completely seized up and took out the entire RAID system with it. And so I jumped in a car and drove 50 miles to Chicago and tried to rebuild the server for Showtime, and we didn't quite make it. We ended up finishing the RAID rebuild. What was it, about 8:30 when we finished?
Closer to 9.
Yeah, but it had to time itself just perfectly so that there was no possible way we could get it rebuilt in time for the show. But we gave it a shot anyways. But we are back, and we are back with an even stronger server from a week ago as our primary server that sends out all the feeds to the secondary servers that you actually listen to. So hopefully things will go completely copacetic tonight, and we'll bring you a intact show from stem to stern, beginning to end. We've got most of the crew here. We haven't quite got everybody. We're still trying to track down Doc Searle, so we'll find him sometime during segment one of the show, I'm sure. But we'll just go ahead and keep moving forward. We do have the rest of the crew here out on the East Coast. How are you doing tonight, Russ?
Oh, hanging in. We're bracing for what the local weathermen are promising to be more or less 7 days of rain. So, oh boy, my life is now complete. And, of course, after this, we figure it's going to be about 3 weeks before they proclaim a drought. So, you know, go figure.
Flood, drought, one thing or the other. Wait 15 minutes and the weather will change.
That's it.
Feast or famine.
Yeah, how are you doing on the other end of the country, Arnie?
Oh, it's beautiful here. And we've been having what they call the June gloom, which is the weather systems coming off the coast and bringing fog and mist and basically gloomy weather and also cool weather inland from the ocean. And it's been nice and cool, and which is nice. My wife and I are going out and buying air conditioner tonight for the oncoming onslaught here at the here in the Inland Valley Desert. So
the summer to come, huh?
Yeah, it's on its way, I'm afraid. And we had a couple of weeks ago some 90-100 degree century temperatures here, and it's on its way. The vegetables are growing right out back behind my office here, and And the zucchini is totally humongous already, so it's going to be a banner year for the tomatoes too, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, I heard a report. I don't know if it's true or not, but I heard a report on one of the lists that I subscribe to that because of this heavy fog and mist that you're experiencing in Southern California, that smog is at almost an all-time high. Is that particularly true?
Yeah, I don't know about that. Might be L.A. I don't pay much attention to it because here in the Inland Valley, we don't get too much now these days. But my wife informs me that 20 years ago it was pretty much unbreathable. But California's done a good job of cleaning the air up, but there could be some, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's some kind of an anomaly is holding the air into the basin.
Yeah.
And the solution to pollution is dilution, and it's not escaping out of the valley and, you know, being filtered off into the rest of the atmosphere.
We need some of those Santa Ana winds to clean the air off.
Yeah, to blow it to Chicago and Canada, right?
No, actually, Santa Ana probably it blows towards the coast.
Whatever. But very cool. Yeah, it's remarkable that your plants are growing so well. The vegetables here in Chicago aren't that far along, but what is going crazy here in the Midwest is because of the incredibly mild winter that we had and literally frost-free spring, which is very rare in this area. The orchards are way far ahead of their normal production.
It's going to be a banner year for the apples in Michigan, I imagine.
Well, not only apples, but the peach orchards. The size of the peaches are incredibly huge already, and it's just the first couple of days of June. It's going to be one of those years where there's so much fruit hanging in the trees, the branches are going to start breaking off the trees. But, the bad comes along with the good, I guess. But, it's really pretty incredible. We got fruit trees lining the street that we live on, and it's just amazing how much fruit are on the street. I'll enjoy it while I got it. I love global warming. I've got no complaints about global warming, so I'm just going to keep on spraying that shit in my backyard and hoping the nice weather holds out. So let's go ahead and jump on into the first segment of the show. And I tell you what, why don't I go to you first, Russ? Why don't you pick up with your first story? And while you're doing that, I'm going to chase off and see if I can find Doc.
Okay. Well, my first story of the week is one called Merrill Lynch, Linux Saves Money. And you can find the link for this over on the Linux Show website. It is a very, very nice piece for a number of reasons, one of which is if you're trying to evangelize your boss, this is the type of thing that you want to show them. There's some great quotes in here, too. Quotes from the Merrill Lynch guys saying it's the people that cost the most, and with that basis he says that Linux is cheaper. He also says we are not trying to promote Linux, we are just trying to reduce the cost of ownership, and that's the name of the game in the business world, and it's showing that Linux is measuring up with that criteria. Another quote from him: we know that Linux is not for everything, but there are not many applications that require more than Linux can give us, and that's more and more the truth these days. That it doesn't have to do absolutely everything, but the stuff that it can do.
I'm sorry, there's no answer.
Is substantial. Are we still here?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay.
We're here. Doc's not though.
Okay, well, we're dockless, such is life. But I think it's a great piece, and if you're evangelizing within your corporation, go for it. Next one would be the story about Intel And it's called Linux Good for 32-chip server. And this this once again hits the scalability issue. If you've been checking out the FUD recently, you'll note that there are still places out there that say, hey, you know, Linux can't scale well beyond four processors. Well, guess what? This is now crap. The Intel has done this. SGI came out with something a couple of months back stating that they got up to around this level of scalability too. Here you have a 32-processor Itanium hitting the 600,000 transaction per minute level.
That's a 64-bit machine, guys.
You know, and it is, but I mean, this is scalability. This is real, honest-to-God scalability. No ifs, ands, or buts that you have Linux making it big on the scene. Apparently, there was an HP Windows box that got up to 700,000 transactions per minute in times past, but it's showing right now that that Linux is competing hard. And considering that this is something that's only come about scalability-wise in the last year or so, this is great lengths, that that have come about here.
So when the new 2.4.6 kernel comes out, or whatever they're going to call it, 2.6 kernel comes out, we'll look for some dramatic speed improvements because on scalability, because the new kernel release it does a lot of stuff. It is linearly, it's not linear scalable. It basically the context switching is basically takes the same amount of time no matter how many processes you have.
It's explicitly,
which is nice.
Parallel is the term, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But order one, context switching.
Yep.
Well, in this article, too, they say that they're not explicit as to whether what kernel was used here. So they may have been using one of the 2.5 development kernels, which is the predecessor to 2.6. But this is just great benchmark. So be encouraged, guys. If you're fighting the battle that Linux can't handle big jobs in terms of multiprocessor, symmetric multiprocessing, that ain't the case. And probably with the next major release, it'll do really, really well. So I'm greatly encouraged about this one.
Yep. Before you go into your next story, I just want everybody to know that Eric has called in.
I'm here.
He's sitting in the background. And, Eric, if you feel like jumping in and commenting on any story, we know that you're shy.
And retiring.
So feel free to jump in.
And unassuming.
Yes. Feel free to jump in on any of the stories during the first half of the show. There's no need for you to sit there quietly if you have something to put in. So have fun. All righty. Russ, go ahead and go back to your third story.
Okay. This one is from ZDNet UK. It says, UK Council dumps Windows for Linux. Very nice little piece here talking about how a couple local authorities there in the UK are going to migrate more than 10,000 desktop systems from Windows to Linux. And this is activity I expect to see a hell of a lot more of in the next 6 to 9 months. The Linux desktop is becoming quite viable in the business world.
We are entering a phase in which big conversion stories on the desktop are becoming routine. Another interesting recent one is Munich.
This is very good. Of course, it's somewhat disconcerting that it's hard to find these stories yet in the U.S. too frequently, but we can only hope that people will learn as they go.
Well, yeah, right there you've hit on something that's really unique, something that should be pointed out, I think. And that is the difference in the coverage between ZDNet UK and ZDNet.com. They really do cover the stories differently. And I think a lot more of these kinds of stories do get picked up and talked about by the staff of ZDNet UK than do in their counterpart in the States. And I think it shows that there is less of an affinity with Microsoft overseas than there obviously historically has been with ZDNet.com. So I think that alone is pretty interesting. Not to mention this stuff, but there's something about this story that just appeals to my prurient interests because the town is Nottingham. there's all kinds of analogies we could use about robbing the rich and giving to the poor. I think that somebody should really come up with something clever dealing with the fact that it does happen to be the Nottingham City Council.
You guys have all seen my When Software Things Were Rotten parody, haven't you?
Oh, sure. Yep.
Pretty funny, too.
Okay, Russ, any more?
Yeah, what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to hit a few of these rapid fire because they kind of stacked up from last week. Take a look if you get a chance. One is in the business section of the New York Post. Now,
I saw that story. That was a good story.
As a former New Yorker, you know, I grew up just north of the city. My dad commuted into Manhattan for 30-odd years. When Linux is hitting the business section of the Post, for crying out loud, you can't get much more mainstream. You know, and in fact, if you take a look at the page, you'll notice that there's the contest to win Yankee tickets right over top. You know, I mean, the Post is not... doesn't tend to waste a whole lot of time with heavy intellectual pursuits. It tends to be rather practical in its focus. But here is the headline of Linux threat to Microsoft is very real.
Did you hit the Wall Street Journal story yet?
No.
I don't have it.
Either today or yesterday, Lee Gomez in the business section. Very interesting coverage from the Wall Street. Interesting partly because it was so quiet, it just took for granted that these things are happening.
Mm.
Well, I mean, it's we've known it's been inevitable for the last 2 or 3 years. It's, and we've been talking about it for well over a year on the Linux show about the desktop and things, how things are going, and now we're just seeing it come to pass. So.
Yeah, but
what I find amusing in both of those stories, the story at the Post and the story in the New York Times, is how now Ballmer's starting to get beat up on, not from the standpoint of the FUD that he's using against the Linux community, or you know, how he's using it to do battle with the Linux community, but now because of the fact that the broader market is hearing those comments that he uses to do battle with the Linux community, those comments are now having a serious, significant impact on their stock price.
Yep.
They're seeing stock shifts from 3 to 5% in a day when Ballmer goes off on one of these tears, and that's pretty significant as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that is wild.
Absolutely.
Okay, last few quickies. One at the Times of India, where you have the president of India urging IT professionals in India to go open source rather than working with Windows. Now, you talk about a government stance on things. That is pretty, pretty wild.
Ooh.
And I think that's quite nice. Take a look at that article if you get the chance.
Yeah. That's President Kalam of India preaching to the techies of India to you know, take a jaundiced eye towards Microsoft and their attempt to buy off the Indian market last fall when they came through and donated, what was it, $500 million. Keep in mind that was tax deductible, so it was, you know, it wasn't an outright gift. It was tax deductible for Microsoft to do that. But I think the interesting timing of that article from President Kalam is the fact that IBM and a number of other Linux companies have made announcements in that market. And when I say in that market, I'm not limiting that just to India. There's a number of things that are going on, not only in India, but in Indonesia and a couple of the other major trade centers of Southeast Asia, where major initiatives are being done to launch product. IBM being one of the producers of an ultra-low-cost Linux, the closest term you can come to identifying it is the set-top box style of PC that is going to be a little Linux box to make computers available to the very poor masses of India. I mean, they can't afford a $200 computer in India because that's a year's salary for some people.
Watch for some of these little boxes to get into the educational institutions. That,
you mean domestically?
Yeah, no, in India.
Well, I think domestically they're going to end up getting into the education market.
That would be nice.
Well, I think it's inevitable. I think it's an inevitable thing.
And that's something, too. Let me just segue right into this other article that I have sitting here. IBM unveils low-cost PC. It talks about how IBM India is put out a Linux-based desktop for the use in the small business and SOHO markets. So here you have something sort of solidifying there that now there are offerings for the small business folks in India. And like you said, it's probably going to spread a whole lot wider than that, given much more time.
In time, yes.
And my last one, just as a quick kicker, there's the one over at VNUNet talking about the fact that in an era where the server market's rather flat, Linux sales are up. Hey, hey. Some serious growth, including, server sales grew 35% in the first 3 months of 2003, according to IDC. So,
so where do you think Ballmer comes up with his number that they actually grew market share this year?
Well, it depends on how much they bought, I guess.
I could start listing probable bodily orifices.
I just.
Is that what they call inflation, Eric?
I just don't know where he got that number he pulled out of the air that Linux has not had
the air. Oh, that's your theory. He pulled it out of the air.
Okay.
Jeff, what did he say?
That Linux has had zero impact. You know, here, this week he says Linux has had a serious impact, right? A week ago, he made a comment that Linux has made zero impact on the server sales, that the only thing that it's done is taken away sales from traditional Unix vendors, which is, of course, an outright lie, but we won't go there.
Please, it's called spin.
Yeah.
He makes it up as he goes on, along.
I know, absolutely. Well, Arnie, I know you got a few stories that we got to get into, and we're a little tight on time. It's already 8:25, so why don't you jump in right away?
Sure. Well, speaking of the desktop, SUSE has come up with a new product called the SUSE Linux Desktop. And as a former SUSE user and still I still like SUSE. SUSE is a nice distribution. I must say that this is looking very, very good. This is an inexpensive desktop system. It features the 2.419 kernel, Glib C225 X-Free 4.3, which is cutting edge, and KDE 3.11, GNOME 2.2, OpenOffice 103, SunStar Office 6, a bunch of other nice little things. And it's been very highly reviewed on on madpenguin.org, and the link's up on the Linux Show website. Also, you'll find the SUSE press release. And as I said earlier, we've been talking about Linux on the desktop for maybe a year and a half or so. And I really do think that things are beginning to gel. I've been using Nopix for some time, last few weeks here. I've been playing around with that. And I must say that the Knopix hardware detection is phenomenally good. And that is runs off a CD. And if SUSE or one of these other outfits grabs some, you know, does a brain share with some of these other European groups there that are putting out these really slick little single CD Linuxes, I think that we'll see an installation that'll make Windows NT installation look sick. I install Windows NT occasionally because I do a lot of building hardware for other people. And I'll tell you right now, a Linux install based on that Knopix would be much better and much more error-free than the current XP install. The XP really has a lot of trouble with hardware. And unless you have a specific installation that in mind where the XP works just real well, XP doesn't install that cleanly, and lots of trouble.
Yeah, but we got to talk reality here, Artie.
Yeah.
Okay.
We got to get it out. We got to get installed.
The number one reality point is most businesses aren't using XP. They're using Windows 2000 Professional,
yeah,
which has an excellent installer. It's easy to configure with a wide variety of old hardware. And it's priced at $129 per desktop.
Yeah, and Windows, I always thought 2000 was a pretty good little, I used it for a while.
The thing with SUSE's product is that it's $100 per desktop.
Yep.
That is, no offense, I know the product is getting great reviews, but at $100 per desktop, that is not going to impress large-scale enterprise companies to consider making the jump to Linux for $29 a desktop. They've got to have more impact than $29 a desktop before they're going to, you know, go from Office 2000.
I'm sure that SUSE, if any large company wanted to license the Linux, SUSE Linux desktop for 10,000 machines or even 100 machines, I'm sure that the price wouldn't be $100 per desktop.
Well, according to SUSE, that's not the case.
No.
It may be when push comes to shove on a sale. But they're pretty firm on their licensing keys. Their licensing keys are available in sets of five for $500. And the person I talked to when I after I looked over the product was pretty firm on that. But the product itself is great. I'm a little iffy at them, and really I don't know if it was SUSE who was doing this or if it was the over enthusiastic author of the article. But calling SUSE's desktop the first enterprise class desktop, I think is really not a very fair statement for them to make. I think the Red Hat, the recent Red Hat desktop is just a fine product, and lots of enterprises around the country are already using it.
And there's LibreNet too, which is a Debian port.
Yep.
Which is really good.
So I think, and again, it may have been Business Wire, the author at Business Wire, that may have been laying grandiose claims to it, but it's great. It looks like a great product. I really am enthused by another good SUSE product.
Well, you know what I'm saying is what we're seeing here is quite a few of these desktops coming out, and of course with competition, though, the prices and the licensing will get all sorted out. I hope.
Yeah, I hope so because I think their pricing, frankly, is a little out of line.
Yeah.
Okay, next story.
Yeah, next one is the Clueless Pundit of the Week, and this week cluelessness goes to John C. Dvorak of PC Magazine, whose column "Killing Linux."
Now stop for 1 minute. I do believe, I may be wrong, we have to go back a couple of years into the archives, but I do believe this is the second time that he has won this award.
Yes, I think so.
So this makes him the first official repeat Clueless Pundit of the Week. That's really saying something.
Yeah, well, John Dvorak's been around since for some time.
The old Stone Age.
Yes. And sometimes I like John, sometimes I don't like John. He's like just one of these guys that, you know, states his opinion. But what I think he's got really wrong here, he's talking about, of course, the SCO case. And he starts out, "The Linux community seems to be taking very lightly the recent events surrounding SCO versus IBM's lawsuit," blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, I want to correct John. No, John, we don't take the case lightly. We take SCO lightly, you know. Actually, a lot of what he says here, and he brings up some good points about David Boies and stuff, but what I really, really find clueless is his conclusions. He's got version A, version B, version C, version D of what's going to happen. Okay, in version A, SCO owns the Unix code. IBM took a license out for AI. The court finds that IBM violated the license, and IBM loses its case. SCO then asserts its intellectual property rights and goes after all Linux companies and users of Linux for fees. Confusion reigns. Linux dies. Version B, SCO pays no attention to the code ownership, concentrates on contract violations with IBM. SCO wins and uses the victory as a precedence to go after the tainted code used by others. Corporations panic and flock to Microsoft. Version C, IBM decides to stall the proceedings. It's using David Boies' old law firm as the battle drags on. The Linux movement loses momentum, then dies. Version D, the case is thrown out of court because it has no merit, and SCO has no platform to stand on because it doesn't own the code. This is what the Linux community is hoping for. Good luck. And, you know, that's his conclusions, and I think they're way off base. Version A, B, and C just don't seem to be highly likely at this point.
There's more likely about 25 different scenarios that this path could follow. But you know what? Let's save that for the second half of the show.
Well, John C. Dvorak, you're the Clueless Pundit of the Week. Congratulations.
Okay. Any more stories, Ernie?
That's it.
Kevin, do you have any new product releases for the week?
Yeah, Zimian Desktop 2 is finally out. I was taking a look at it today at work. It's a very slick, integrated GNOME 2-based desktop. Probably have a more in-depth review in the coming weeks, but go ahead and check it out. It's got a great package manager. It's got Evolution, which is very good mail reader calendar type of setup. And it plays nicely with Red Hat 8 and 9.
It really does, huh?
Yep.
That's cool. I'm going to have to check that out then. Okay, well, if there's no more stories, then let's go ahead and take our break. It is half past the hour anyway, so why doesn't everybody out there in the IRC kick back, get your fingers warmed up, because I know you're going to have questions for Eric. Please hold off on the questions for about the first 5 or 10 minutes. We want to give people a little chance to just chat with Eric first, and as the segment number 2 winds on, then feel free to throw your questions out into the IRC, and one of us will pick them up and bring them into the conversation. So everybody, kick back, relax. Kevin, put on a tune. This is the Linux Show for Tuesday, June the 10th, 2003. Man, the first half of this year is gone by fast. Can't believe it. We'll be right back, everybody. Hang in there.
While tearing off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy. But when I do, I don't follow through because my heart belongs to daddy. If I invite a guy from my to dine out to Fife and Hattie, a juicy John, he's asking for more, but my heart belongs to daddy. My heart belongs to daddy. Simply couldn't be bad. And my heart so well.
And we're back.
It's the Lennox Show for Tuesday, June the 10th, 2003. I'd like to take this moment to thank a number of people. First of all, I'd like to thank all the people at Acme for bailing us out last week and actually staying late last night so that I could go in and get into the building where our Chicago Pop is. I don't know where my key is. Now, there's a real brilliant thing when you've got a pop that you're supposed to have 24/7, and I lost the key. But the folks at Acme did bail me out and hung around and let me get into their building in Chicago late on Tuesday night. I was there until about midnight last week working on our server. And also, there was quite a number of people that hung around even though there was no show last week and just sort of chatted with each other in the IRC, and they hung out. And in particular, I'd first of all like to thank Arnie for really leading the discussion. There's a lot of people who emailed me during the course of the week and said that Arnie was a real asset in that while Kevin and I were off juggling computer parts, Arnie sort of held up his end in keeping things moving forward. And I'd also like to thank three listeners in particular. One of the listeners is Charles Tryon. Another one is, let me look up his name, Charles Nardino. And the third one is Alan Snyder. These three listeners were very gracious in that the three of them got together and made a very, very sizable donation to the Linux Show to not only pay for our phone bill for the next month, but also paid a good chunk of the parts that we needed to put into that server last week. So really do want to thank these guys for stepping forward. All three of them are old-time listeners, the guys that just sit out there quietly hanging out in the IRC, and you know, don't talk much, but they're real faithful listeners of the show. And in particular, Alan. Alan gave a huge donation, and we're going to actually give him a full month's sponsorship.
Alan is actually a new listener.
Well, he's been listening a few weeks.
Yeah.
But Alan, we're going to he's going to hook up with a Linux user group and use his one-month sponsorship to plug a Linux group or some project. I don't know. It's up to him to pick, not me. But, again, I'd like to thank them a lot. If it's the listeners and some of our corporate sponsors as well that from time to time, boy, those magic checks that just come out of nowhere, just keep on paying the bills and keep us on the air. It's amazing. This is we're going into our sixth year. So we really do appreciate both the individual and the corporate sponsorships as well. If you're interested in throwing a little cash our way, just go to the website and you will see a link, a little PayPal button. Just click on the button and the sponsorship information is right there. And thanks again to those three gentlemen for coming to our aid and bailing us out when we really needed it. So on to segment two. Obviously, Eric is here, so we won't go through the silliness of an in-depth introduction. We'll just jump right into the meat of the segment. Obviously, the SCO story has been as big for 2003 as the Microsoft versus the Department of Justice story was in 2000 and 2001. This has been the central story, well, if not the whole year, at least for the last 3 months, and has been consuming at least a quarter of every show for the last couple of months. And so now that the story is really trying to getting to a point where it's reaching maturity, we're actually getting information scant, but we are getting some information leaked out, and some of our organizations have had a chance to actually look at information and prepare position papers. It's really time for us to start having people like Eric on the show to really give some real in-depth commentary of what's going on. And, well, so Eric, why don't you just jump in and first talk about the OSI position paper.
Sure. This is something that I and my friend Rob Landley put together. It immediately after the SCO complaint was made public, we looked through it, and there were so many howlers in that complaint, things that were either the product of ignorance or outright lying, that we just couldn't stand it. And we sat down to write a detailed dissection of the most outrageous claims in that document. We didn't hit all of them. We didn't mention, for example, the fact that the complaint describes Richard Stallman as, quote, a professor, unquote, in MIT. We didn't even hit all the little tiny factual errors. What we were concerned to do is address the most egregious and plausible lies, things that are really untrue and damaging but might sound reasonable if you're somebody who doesn't know the history of Unix and doesn't know the open source community. And I felt qualified to do this because, as all of you on the show know, and as a lot of your listeners will probably know too, I've been paying close attention to the history of the Unix community and the hacker culture for a long time. In fact, I was there when a fair bit of it happened. So between that knowledge base that comes from having been around for about 20 years and the fact that my friend Rob is a very good research assistant who can read financial documents much better than I can, we were able to put together a pretty convincing rebuttal to that case, which has subsequently, I think, formed a factual basis for a lot of the very skeptical press coverage that we've been seeing on this lawsuit.
It seems to. I agree. A surprising number of the mainstream media outlets seem to be pointing towards the OSI position paper. So it's already been shown value as an asset. So you guys obviously did a good job and did your homework on it.
Are you aiming to submit this or some version of this as a friend of the?
Yes, in fact, that was the original intention. The original intention was to design it as a brief of amicus curia, and you can see that that's true by looking at some of the language in it, which is quite legalistic.
Also, it's heavily footnoted, and that's another thing that gives that away.
Right. I consulted with OSIS counsel, the very able lawyer Larry Rosen, and he told me that it would not be appropriate for OSI to attempt to file a brief of amicus at this stage of the proceedings before they actually go to trial. So we just recast it as a position paper and took out some of the more obvious legal hooks.
Yeah, there's been a number of comments, in fact, tonight in the IRC. Although I don't agree, there have been some comments saying rather than writing what is obviously a brief, the position paper reads like a brief.
Yeah.
So rather than doing that and filing a friend of the court petition, why don't you just file your own lawsuit against SCO?
Because I don't have the money to do it.
Have you asked your lawyer what it might cost?
I didn't have to. I know it would be too expensive. I have contemplated various ways in which the community could mount a legal action on its own, and I'm not going to talk about those, but I'm going to talk with some people who might have the resources and the right connections.
Yeah, well...
Well, we've already had two small little cases filed in Europe, one upheld by a German judge, and one recently, the last couple of days, filed by Polish companies, which are charging SCO with constraint of trade.
And in the U.S., it is possible that Unix vendors might have a trade libel cause of action against SCO. For the manner in which they have attempted to prejudge this case in the court of public opinion.
Yeah, because I think that would be very, very beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people there out there that are consultants and system integrators that are you know, you say you can't afford to do a lawsuit. You know, they're geometrically a couple levels of progression below you.
Don't bet on it. I'm not a rich guy.
Well, I know that, but you have a reputation within the industry that if you if all you needed to do was raise $5,000 or $10,000 to start a lawsuit, you can't tell me that you couldn't do that real quick, just based upon your reputation.
I never really thought of it in those terms.
Okay. You know, put one PayPal link out on Slashdot, and you're going to raise $5,000.
$5,000 isn't even table stakes in a lawsuit like this.
I realize that, but that's why this is where I'm going, Eric.
Yeah,
is there's people out there that are small business people that they can't afford $5,000, whereas you could raise it easily, but it's not enough for the kind of thing that you would want to do.
Right,
but if the details of the position paper could be developed into such a way as there's something within business law called a Pettit suit. It's a small claims suit. It's for an issue that's under $5,000.
Uh-huh.
If something in that vein could be developed that people could freely pick up on, it only costs, well, depending upon where you're living in the country, you know, $100 to $150 to file a small claims suit if they've got grounds. But, you know, your average Joe Blow integrator, you know, he doesn't have a clue how to put together the verbiage to...
I think a more plausible way to do this, if we're going to do it, would be to try and put together a coalition of Linux distributors to collectively mount a trade libel action. Because they are very clearly injured parties.
Well, without doubt. Without doubt. But...
And it could that could evolve into a class action.
Right. So let me tell you a bit about what I am doing instead of speculating about what I might do in the future.
Okay, yeah, that's fair enough.
First of all, if you don't already know about it, you should know about my No Secrets page, easily findable via the web or on my site. A thing that we can attack very directly is SCO has hinted that it may... sue for relief on a trade secret theory. That is, that it has valuable trade secrets which IBM breached. What I'm doing about this is I have a web page where I am collecting stories from people who have had access to proprietary Unix source code in a situation where they were not under NDA or where that NDA was not attempted to be enforced by the people who signed them up. Okay. The reason this is significant is because trade secrecy is a very fragile status, and trade secrecy breaks open rather than closed. Even inadvertent disclosure of a trade secret removes the trade secrecy protection. This became an issue most recently in the Brunner case in California, the DVD CCA lawsuit, in which they lost the option to pursue a trade secret argument when it was determined that they had placed a copy of the DECSS source code in a court exhibit. Even that degree of publication, which was a mistake, which was accidental on their part, destroyed their option to sue on a trade secret theory. So it doesn't take much to abolish trade secrecy, and what I want to show, I want to be able to walk into court with a bunch of affidavits certifying a pattern of by Unix vendors over the of being extremely careless about source disclosure and doing things which had the effect of exposing thousands of people to Unix source code under conditions where they were not NDA'd, and I can prove that.
Dan.
Hello?
You can prove that.
Yes, I can prove that.
Okay.
I have some people, I have over 60 people willing to sign affidavits under circumstances which basically destroy any claim to trade secrecy protection. And a couple of these are real big smoking guns that I'm not going to talk about because it'll be much more effective if they advance a trade secret argument and we have to counter this in court. It will be much more effective if they don't know about these cases in advance.
I'm sure. Have you gotten Peter's comment on it?
Sorry, Peter.
Salas,
sure. Yeah. No. Oddly enough, I haven't heard from Peter since this thing started. I say oddly enough because he is the other most obvious person to have written that position paper and commented on the history of all this.
Absolutely, and I've been surprised by his quietness.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there wondering when the shoe's going to drop.
Maybe I'll send him an email and find out. Or, I don't know, maybe he figures Rob and I did a good enough job that he can pay attention to other things.
I'd like to hear what he has to say to me.
Yeah, so would I, actually.
Let's get him involved. Shake him up.
Yeah.
Peter, you here listening?
Hello, Peter.
So what else is going to be happening besides proving the NDA is a fallacy?
Okay.
Yeah, let's talk about the NDA. That's important.
Right. Okay, first of all, I need to be honest and tell you that there are some things I know that I can't talk about.
Talk about them then.
So I'm going to... all the things I'm going to say to you are strictly going to be on the basis of public information. I'll tell you what my speculation about what I think is going to happen next. On the 16th, SEO is going to say, IBM, your license is gone. You can no longer distribute Unix derived from System 5 Release 4 code or whatever. I have seen the language that is in IBM's document, the terms under which they bought out their obligation to pay license royalties. This is a deal that they did with SCO some years back, where they bought a perpetual irrevocable license to Unix technology for a large lump sum. I've seen the language of that document, and it does, in fact, very explicitly empower IBM to create a derivative works and essentially use the technology in any way that it sees fit. And I don't have to be IBM's lawyers or be talking to IBM's lawyers to predict that IBM's response to that revocation is going to be, look at the languages in this agreement. You do not have grounds to revoke our contract. In fact, it is irrevocable by the definitions of the language that is within it, so go pound sand. And at that point, SCO will doubtless issue a large cloud of FUD, like a squid emitting ink, and then it will go shopping for a temporary restraining order from the judge in the case. Now, a TRO is something that, as an injured party, you seek if you believe that the other party's failure to comply with your demands is going to do immediate and irrevocable injury to your business, and SCO is going to claim that that's happening. And they'll go to the judge for that, and then their lawyers and IBM's lawyers will argue in court over whether they should get a TRO or not. And the standard in these situations is the judge is not supposed to grant a TRO if he thinks that the other party has any substantial likelihood of prevailing in its case. So unless the judge believes that IBM has no substantial likelihood of prevailing in its case, that TRO is going to be denied, and I believe that's what's going to happen. And then they're going to go into formal discovery, okay, which is preparations for the actual trial. And at that point, the code overlaps that SCO is alleging are going to have to go public because IBM, in a case of this kind, IBM has a legal right to be able to examine the evidence that SCO supposedly has against it, not just at trial, but before trial so that it can prepare its defense. So
these things can be sealed, though, can't they?
That's right. It may be that the public will not get to see this information.
Yeah, but in IBM's case, even if they lose that initial argument, they're going to pay a bond.
Right. So here's what I think is going to happen. IBM is going to say screw you. SCO is going to go shopping for a temporary restraining order. The temporary restraining order is going to be denied, and at that point they go into the normal process of pretrial discovery. And all of this is a fairly standard dance in lawsuits of this kind. This is the normal sequence of events. And as I said, at that point they'll go into discovery. IBM will get from SCO the alleged code overlaps. And it will then put its own people on the job of doing a forensic analysis of the comparisons in the code.
What likelihood is it that there's some, that SCO's claims are based on some kind of fact?
Okay.
And what will the repercussions of that be?
To the best of my awareness, the only public information on that, and I'll go further and say this is the only information I have. The only public information on that is what came out in the Electronic Engineering Times article a couple days ago, where an analyst said that he had been shown up to 80 lines of overlapping code.
And that's laughable.
Okay.
Is this in one chunk or in 80 chunks?
The way the article was phrased that he had seen no more than 80 lines of overlapping code.
Yeah.
Now, of course, in a kernel code base of 3.3 million lines,
that's it. Right?
80 lines is a rounding error.
That's what's so laughable about it. We're talking about substantial intellectual property of 80 lines of code. in excess of 3 million lines of code. It's less than 1% of 1% of 1%.
Okay, so now I'm going to speculate a little further. I have a theory about where that overlapping code came from. Based on my reading of the history of the Unix versions involved, the only reasonable way, the most likely way for that to have gotten in there, there's a couple of other ways actually that are reasonable, including SCO putting it in there themselves. Not with malice, by the way. I'll get to that in a moment. But the most likely way for that code to have gotten in there is if it is common inheritance from the BSD source code.
That's what I was going to say, BSD.
And that is legally significant because one of the constraints that SCO is operating under is the 1993 settlement of the AT&T versus BSD lawsuit, in which AT&T and Novell effectively lost proprietary claims over a good deal of the code in System 5, that is, the code that was common with the BSD releases, because a judge found that AT&T had incorporated substantial code from the BSDs in their operating system, which was okay, but they had also, in violation of the BSD license, stripped off the attribution notices, and that was not okay. And so what happened was AT&T decided to crush its competition at Berkeley. They went after Berkeley and sued them for trade secret and copyright violations. Berkeley looked at the code, said, wait a second, you guys stole a bunch of our code, stripped the licenses off it, and that's illegal, and therefore we're going to sue you, we're going to countersue you and say you don't have the rights to that code and you can't sue us over anything. And a judge took a look at the claims of the contending parties, took a look at the code, took a look at the analysis, and he issued a couple of very pissed off findings which in effect said, get the hell out of my courtroom and settle. And that's what they did. He found a substantial likelihood that BSD would prevail on the merits of its case. And the two parties got out of the courtroom and settled. And the upshot was a settlement in which BSD had to put AT&T copyright in 3 out of the 16,000 source files in its distribution. And in return, AT&T and Novell agreed that they and their successors were relinquishing proprietary claims over the BSD code. So the situation we're left with is at that point the cleaned up version of BSD with those 3 copyrights in it, which was BSD 4.3 Lite, was unencumbered by AT&T intellectual property claims, but that also implies that the BSD code that was within the System 5 Release 4 distribution, the stuff that AT&T had illegally lifted in the first place, is also something that neither AT&T nor Novell nor SCO nor SCO Caldera could assert proprietary claims over. And the most likely scenario, in my opinion, is that the code overlap they're looking at comes from that BSD-derived code.
And also, they can't prove it otherwise, can they?
Right. They were in a situation where they had some developers who were making major contributions to the Linux kernel source code, including Tigran Alvazian and Christoph Hellwig. And the burden of proof is going to be on them to demonstrate that technology passed into the kernel through IBM and not through their own kernel developers.
Yeah, this is another interesting thing. Something hit the wires just before showtime, and that is a link on Slashdot, which asked the question: did SCO borrow Linux code?
Right.
And there and here, this is very interesting because what this claims is that in building the Linux kernel personality for SCO Unix,
yeah,
SCO actually has taken code, GPL code from the Linux kernel, or actually functionality, whether it's actual code or not, and incorporated it into their product.
That's certainly possible.
Now, how much of this will poison their claims?
Well, let me put it this way. If that comes out at trial, I wouldn't want to be SCO's lawyers.
Or David Boies.
I know. everybody keeps saying, ooh, ooh, David Blois, the sky is falling. But, you know, it doesn't worry me at all. As far as I'm concerned, the guy's a three-time loser.
Yeah, Show me a case he's won.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he's a famous lawyer and everything, but I haven't seen him win anything. But, okay, let's turn this about 15 degrees. The first thing, okay, we've already been talking about a little bit about how Skull may have done some of this, this 80 lines of borrowed code on their own. You know, they really don't know that. But, Eric, I got to tell you, back a couple of years ago when Caldera did their IPO, and they immediately, as soon as they did that IPO, they immediately took the cash and grabbed SCO before somebody else did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When that happened, okay, we were all at Linux World Expo when Caldera was bragging about the fact that they had just gotten SCO, that they had just gotten their hands on the Unix source code, and I swear to you, there were SCO employees at that time bragging about the fact that they were already incorporating source code into the Linux kernel. You know, minor stuff. It was stuff like drivers and things like that. But within a month's purchase, they were bragging about it.
Right. I think that's actually very likely. Actually, at this point, I should utter a disclaimer that I actually should have uttered at the beginning of my rant here. I am not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer. I'm married to a lawyer, and I've studied some of the relevant law, but I am not a lawyer. So do not take any of this as legal opinions. So what else should we cover?
Well, I think that's a good chunk of it. Do you think that this is really going to go much beyond August?
I think that with the bimpty bump $1 billion that Microsoft gave them, SCO has the capability to drag this out for a while. I frankly don't think they have a snowball's chance in hell of winning their case.
Yeah, media.
And that's not my Linux advocate head talking. That comes from the fact that I know the history. I've examined some of the relevant law, and I've talked to people who are smarter about the law than I am, and I don't think they have a snowball's chance in hell.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to also throw out one little piece of information here that I find is very interesting. And that deal, that goes back with to the overall issue of this extremely restrictive NDA that SCO has been asking pundits to sign before they show them this 80 lines of code.
And most of them have been refusing.
Yes. The vast majority of the people in the press, including myself, have refused to sign this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we are asked to sign NDAs from time to time, but they're generally very lightweight NDAs, and they're dated. Basically, the purpose of most NDAs is so that you don't release the story before they've had a chance to release the press release.
Right.
So it's as much a courtesy to the company as anything else.
Right. By the way, my policy on this is I never sign NDAs. My attitude is, if you don't trust me enough to hold things in confidence, I don't want to talk to you.
Yep, yeah, I agree. But
question from the IRC.
Well, hang on a second. Let me finish this, Arnie, because I think this is very relevant.
Yeah.
I have been asked by SCO to come to a meeting with them on August the 18th, at which time they're supposed to show me the source code without signing an NDA.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So there's something about August. I don't know what it is. But I don't know. That's what they told me. They said they'd show me the source code without an NDA.
You know, the really weird thing about this whole NDA thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that if the source code is, as they say, already in the Linux kernel, then everyone's seen it.
Right.
Why don't they just identify what the lines are? If they want to say, well, we have proof that it was in our code, well, fine. But, you know, why not at least say, well, since you're looking at the code anyway, look at lines, 3,432 through 36 in, this module.
Would you like me to speculate?
I think we can all speculate, but go ahead.
Speculate. It's pretty damn obvious.
Yeah.
I think I know why they're taking the position they are. My theory about this is that from SCO's point of view, this whole sequence of events has completely gotten out of control. I think that their original intention was to use the threat of a lawsuit to shake down IBM for money. And I don't think they wanted to go to court. I don't think they wanted to be in court. I think they wanted to threaten IBM, collect their money, and use that as a basis to be able to threaten other people. The problem is now they're in a situation where if they back down, if they don't pursue this to the end, there's possible legal blowback for them for having uttered a fraudulent complaint.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in a situation now where I don't think anybody at SCO thinks they can win either, but everybody who's involved, all the management that's been involved, needs to go down with the ship in order to avoid legal consequences to themselves.
That's right. Darryl's butt is on the line right now.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It all boils down to Darryl's butt. And that's why I can't wait for August, is because I've got some quotes from a year ago that turned out to be absolute stone-faced lies.
Mm-hmm.
That came out of his mouth last September.
Well, you don't have to look at a year ago. I mean, Darryl has changed his story several times, for example, about whether the code was in the kernel or not.
Yep.
And public statements.
But
yeah, at first he said Linux isn't affected.
Yeah.
Publicly.
Yeah. So what we have here is obvious thrashing by people who need to keep the lawsuit process going in order to shield themselves, but probably don't think they can win.
Yep.
What about this bait that they cast out there that if IBM bought them out, that it would kind of make it moot?
Well, of course, that was the objective of the whole exercise to begin with.
Illegal, I would think. That's like blackmail.
Yeah. And that's why they have to go down with the ship, because if they don't, they can be sued for bigotry.
That's serious stuff.
They can be sued by the stockholders of SCO.
Yeah.
Well, furthermore, we have a question from the IRC channel, and they've been more than one person has asked about this. How about Novell? How does this enter in there?
I don't understand the question, which seems to have been kind of debunked
recently, the last couple of days. But what about the Novell claim that they have the intellectual property rights?
I don't have any information that you don't, but here's what I think based on the public sources. I suspect that there was some intent to transfer some copyrights when the original deal happened. The scope of the copyrights to be transferred was never specified, and furthermore, it seems pretty clear from the public record that there was no transfer of copyrights ever executed with the USPTO. So at this point, based on the public evidence, it's not at all clear to me that anyone on the planet knows who owns those copyrights. But for legal purposes, a significant datum is the fact that since the transfer of copyright was not registered under U.S. federal statute, the ability of SCO to sue for recovery is very strictly limited. In fact, they cannot collect damages exceeding $150,000. Because you can't do that unless you have copyright that was not only legal but registered at the time of the infraction.
$150,000 is still pretty substantial.
It won't keep them in business, and it won't keep SCO from going down.
Is that $150,000 per lawsuit though? Is it not, or is that $150,000 cumulative?
The statute doesn't say. I think it's generally read as $150,000 per willful violation, which probably means they can't recover from IBM more than once.
Yeah, but they can recover $150,000 from every mom-and-pop ISP across the U.S. that has a Linux server?
It's not at all clear, because in order to willful violation is a different category from violation. And
that's true. That's
yeah,
true.
That's right. And if the copyright isn't registered and it's more than 3 years from the date of the infringement, you can't recover for non-willful infringement at all.
And let's not forget that SCO themselves is releasing the code for free
under
GPL.
That's right.
And what does that do, Eric?
Well,
that's a real naughty thing for SCO.
Right. It depends on how the judge reads Clause 7 of the GPL. Clause 7 of the GPL is the clause that bars you from limiting the rights of the licensees through side agreements or other instruments, and that could be read in its most general sense. It could be read from that SCO is actually barred from suing anybody on a trade secret, copyright, or even patent violation on any code that it itself distributed. That would not be an unreasonable way to read that clause. And that's one reason why I think that even without all these facts, SCO is going to have a lot of trouble winning. Yet a third reason it's going to have a lot of trouble winning its case is because of an argument that wouldn't occur to most hackers who don't think in terms of a world of malicious actors, but would occur to a judge, and that is, if I rule that these guys have a contract violation case against IBM, despite the fact that it's quite possible that that code was inserted there by SCO employees, am I setting a precedent that would lead to companies maliciously planting code in their competitors' projects during open source or closed source cooperation, and then later on suing on that theory?
Mm-hmm.
From a judge's point of view, that's a very serious question. And it's in a lot of cases analogous to this, judges have said to the plaintiffs, get the hell out of my courtroom because you don't have clean hands. Clean hands is a relevant legal term of art in this situation.
I got some questions. First one, I know you're pretty closed mouth on the 60 people ready to testify, but... if you choose to answer this, you can just answer it as a yes or no question.
Sure.
Are any of the 60 present or former employees of SCO?
Not yet.
Good enough.
Very precise. Do you know anything about, what about the Microsoft licensing, SCO licensing thing? Do you know anything about that?
Only what's in the public sources. One thing I can tell you is there's been a lot of what is apparently misinformation about the amount of money they got. There was speculation in the press that it amounted to $10 or $11 million, but my friend Rob Landley examined SCO's financials, examined their quarterly report, and based on the numbers for their revenues, it isn't possible that they got more than $8 million. And the actual amount is probably somewhere between $4 and $8 million.
And so it's less money than what has been said.
That's right.
But what is significant is all of a sudden out of nowhere they had a profitable quarter.
That's right. Without that money, without the Microsoft subvention for them to attack IBM, they would not have had a profitable quarter.
Yep, and they would not have been able to say, see, our Unix product is profitable. We don't need that Linux stuff anyways.
when in fact, the lion's share of their revenue is coming directly from the legal action, the fact that somebody else wanted to subsidize it.
Yep.
SCO's got a history of that, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. One thing that seems pretty clear to me is that they're trying to repeat their success against Microsoft, where they were able to shake down Microsoft for a lot of money over the Dr. DOS rights, which, by the way, is not a technology they originated, but they bought the right to continue that lawsuit.
Same thing with the Unix.
Yeah, yeah.
SCO didn't invent Unix. It was invented at AT&T Bell Labs.
This is a continuing history in specifically Caldera's behavior. Caldera bought Dr. DOS. Was able to
from Novell, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they were able to force a settlement with Microsoft that got them $150. And what was that, Rob? They kept running until they ran out of that money, and then they sued IBM.
Hmm.
Yep. There's your pattern right there. Any more questions out of the IRC, guys? Well, if no one's jumping up and saying so, we are 20 past the hour already. Eric, this has been a very interesting segment. Always entertaining to have you come along for the ride. This is, like I said at the beginning of the show, probably the you know going to come down as the most significant story of 2003. And we'd love to have you come back as things move forward. And I tell you, I will be on the phone to you in August, about the 18th of August, as soon as I actually, first of if. Actually show me the source code without an NDA. And if I get the ability to see that source code, I'm going to immediately broadcast it to the Linux community so that the hackers can pull it out of the code. If it,
right.
if it is indeed legitimate, it should be pulled out.
Right. But if it's 80 lines, that's going to take about 3 hours.
Yeah. And that is why SCO doesn't want people to know about it.
Right.
Because they know it'll only take 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the absurdity of the whole thing.
And every single line in source code line in Linux is traceable to its source.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. I don't think that's true before about 2001, because Linux didn't start keeping detailed change logs before then.
Ah, okay.
So there's kind of a window there. On the other hand, before then, patches were commonly posted to the Linux kernel mailing list. And there are archives going back further than that. The thing is, I wouldn't bet against there being some code that fell through the cracks, and we'll just have to hope that whatever this overlap is was not in that category.
Well, there is some inevitable copying, because
yeah.
there are basic statements that you can only write one way.
Right.
A plus B equals C can only be written as A plus B equals C.
I'll tell you something else I'm fairly sure of based on the public information. I don't think that code is anywhere vital. And the reason I say that is I'm extrapolating from the behavior of McBride and his cronies. If at this point, because of their posture in the lawsuit, if they were able to say in public that Linux would not run without the overlapping code, they certainly would have done so.
Yep.
So the fact that they're not claiming that Linux is crippled without it tells me that this code is nowhere essential, and that if necessary, we could simply yank it and keep going.
Whereas the Linux personality code is mission critical to Unixware to allow it to run Linux applications. So they are in a bind here.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't look pretty for them just about any way you slice it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been great. Come back again soon, Eric. It's been a lot of fun. On behalf of the whole crew here at the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show, this has been our show for June the 10th, 2003. Thanks again to those guys for picking up the ball and helping to sponsor the Linux Show in our hour of need. You can find a PayPal link on our website, www.thelinuxshow.com. We appreciate any support you can throw our way. And otherwise, just be back next week, same time, same place. Tell 10 of your friends.
Mm-hmm.
Let's grow the Linux Show community. We'll see everybody next week. We are out of here.
Although I've never been to Rio, there's something saying to me, come. 'Cause there's a chance I just might find my big romance there, Rio de Janeiro. Tomorrow I may fly to Rio to find the love I need to know. Someone is waiting for me somewhere, and it could be Rio de Janeiro.